We're back on Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin, and we're talking with former Kentucky Poet Laureate, Transylvania University English professor, author, and admitted topophiliac, Richard Taylor. He has written more than a dozen books, and they include Sue Mundy, Gertie, and Earth Bones. The cover of his latest, published by the University Press of Kentucky, sports the Thomas D. Clark Medallion. In Elkhorn, Evolution of a Kentucky Landscape, Dr. Taylor offers a snapshot of the economic, social, and cultural transformation of Kentucky captured within an 8-mile stretch of Elkhorn Creek, from the Forks of Elkhorn to Knight's Bridge. And as fellow Kentucky author Eric Reese put it, he does so with a poet's eye and a historian's curiosity. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Taylor.
Happy to be here.
First, topophilia, or topophilia, whichever it is. I just want to assure our listeners that it is not a malady, far from it, that you are okay, and that many Kentuckians have it. Could you elaborate on what that is?
Topophilia is a term that was coined by the poet W.H. Auden, and it means basically place and love of place. And that, as you mentioned, I think most Kentuckians would identify with that.
So let's get our bearings before we dive into the book. Where exactly is the section of the creek that is the focus of your book?
The section of the creek that is the focus of my book is it begins on Highway 460, where it crosses at a place called the Forks of Elkhorn. The Forks of Elkhorn, geographically, is the convergence of the South and North Forks of Elkhorn Creek. It formed to form the main stem of Elkhorn Creek, which runs approximately, 12 or 16 miles to the Kentucky River. Elkhorn is the second largest tributary of the Kentucky River.
And it has become, had become, something of a touchstone for you personally. Why is that?
It is that because when I took a job at Kentucky State University in 1975, I bought an old house that I began to discover a lot of historical connections.
And this is the Giltner Holt House. Correct?
The Giltner Holt House. Mm-hmm. And among the things I learned was that history began at my doorstep, an 1870 newspaper article. Mentioned the capture of two slaves in the front who were cutting wood in the front yard during the last major Indian foray into Franklin County, which occurred in 1792, the year of statehood. And from that, from my doorstep, I discovered that the person who originally owned the property was the first federal judge west of the mountains. His name was Harry Innes. He was an immigrant from Virginia and was very prominent in the formation, not only the formation of Frankfort as the as state's capital, but also Kentucky as a state. He was one of the persons who attended the 8 or 10 conventions that resulted in Kentucky statehood.
Do you ever stand there and imagine the voices of people from the past and the activities that happened there?
I do. That area, that 8-mile stretch, is fraught with history. An Indian massacre, a major early industrial complex with the Stedman paper mill, Paul Sawyer associations. The book contains lots of references to the local history, and I think about it often. I think most often, I guess, about Sawyer himself, who knew that creek and documented it perhaps more fully than any state in Kentucky, at least in terms of painting.
And how far from your house is Elkhorn Creek? Can you actually see it?
I can see the bluffs above Elkhorn Creek, the Palisades above Elkhorn Creek from my lower hill. So as the crow flies, maybe three-quarters of a mile, but it's a clear shot across that valley, which the Elkhorn Valley, of course, is the product of eons of erosion. And so on my lower hill, I can look straight out and see what was formerly a piece of property that was contiguous to mine before the valley was carved out.
And what is it about the creek and this landscape that you describe that spoke to you in a way that inspired you to write about it in an historical context?
Visibly, Elkhorn is fairly pristine. It's pristine because around it, the banks around it are either agricultural or undevelopable. So when I kayak down Elkhorn Creek, I can go with a sense of following Boone's prow, so to speak. It is timbered. It is relatively wild. And relatively peopleless, except for the persons who fish there and kayak there, and a few people along the edges who farm it.
It's difficult in a brief radio interview to do full justice to a book. So instead of attempting that, I'd like to ask you to tease our imaginations, if you will, by touching on some random chapters. And one that comes to mind is The Ones Who Came Before.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, you know, there used to be a standing view that Native Americans never really lived in Kentucky. And that fact, that contention is utterly untrue. Native Americans have lived on the creek since the end of the last ice age, from about 12,000 years ago until about, let's say, 1750, when Euro-Americans came into Kentucky, mostly from the east.
Another chapter that really captured my eye was the Cook Massacre. What happened there?
Well, the Cook Massacre, unlike many tales of the frontier, highlighted women. Two heroic women withstood an attack of 100 or so Wyandot Indians who had shot their husbands, and they barricaded themselves in a cabin. They managed to shoot one of the attackers. Interestingly enough, that attacker's body was placed in the creek. It floated a mile and a half or 2 miles and lodged itself on an enormous piece of limestone, which is still to this day known as Indian Rock.
Hmm. And the entrepreneur of the Elkhorn?
A.W. Macklin is one probably, and I don't have statistics to back this up, but he was probably at his death in 1863, one of the wealthiest men in Kentucky. He was the son of an Irish immigrant. It's a great American success story. He owned not and created, really, not only three mills on the creek, but owned a vast amount of real estate, a slaughterhouse in Frankfort, a coal operation which had its roots in eastern Kentucky. He was truly an entrepreneur of the captains of industry mold.
Elkhorn is illustrated by numerous photographs, paintings, portraits, even your own sketch of your home. In fact, it's fun just to flip through just to get a visual sense of where we're talking about and who we're talking about. Of course, we're on the radio, so no picture here. So, listener, you have to pick up the book and do what I did and turn through its pages to appreciate what I'm talking about. But, Dr. Taylor, I wonder if you could comment on your choices of imagery.
Well, those chapters that center on individuals, I simply went to what existing images there were, including portraits from the Speed Museum of Harry Innes and his wife, photographs where they existed in the files, say, of the Frankfurt History Museum, the City Museum as well. In a few cases, I had to look pretty hard. There are very few depictions, for instance, of the first comers that we talked about. What did these people who lived along Elkhorn look like? We don't know the name of a single one of them. We don't have an image, an accurate image of any of them. So I had to kind of extrapolate and find faces that I could imagine living along the creek.
We're talking with Richard Taylor, author of Elkhorn, Evolution of a Kentucky Landscape. In your book, you talk about Elkhorn Creek as an inspiration for many forms of creativity and art. What art forms have been inspired by this place?
Well, as I mentioned, Paul Sawyer, of course, who is the dean, perhaps, of Kentucky painters, at least 19th and early 20th century painters. But he's inspired a number of people who come and do plein air painting along the creek. And I won't trouble you with their names. Well, Ellen Glasgow, Betty Beshore, or Karen Carey are friends whom I know regularly paint along the creek. But it's also been an inspiration just for people to reflect. I'm convinced that the fishermen who come to Elkhorn Creek come as much to escape the distractions of urban living as they do to catch fish. And so that's inspired poetry. It's inspired, I guess, to some degree, fiction. It's certainly been a rich source of historical research.
And shortly we'll get to a piece of art that inspired you. But first, I want to ask you about an observation that I came across in the book by David Orr. Begins a chapter. And if I may, he comments that liberal arts education that involves a familiarity with nature would teach students that there are some things that just can't be said about a mountain or a forest or a river, things too subtle or too powerful to be caught in the net of science, language, and intellect. It would introduce students to the mysterious and unknowable before the mere unknowns of a particular discipline. You're an educator, so I assume you included that for that reason, but could you elaborate on it?
Actually, that passage by David Orr was from a book I was teaching to my freshman students in the freshman seminar, and it's called Earth in Mind. And the idea is that we are surrounded by mystery, and I guess characteristically of the Western mind, we don't really probe into things that aren't tangible. We're very comfortable talking about the material world, but we've done very little to explore the mysteriousness that David Orr is referring to there. And it might mean a recreation of the lives of people who live there. It might mean the multitude of forces that engender life along the creek and the incredibly intricate relationships between, for instance, organisms in the creek and the lives of others along the creek. One of the major thrusts of the book that pricked my conscience was the environmental issues. Elkhorn Creek, though it looks pristine, in fact is not, and its waters are very carefully monitored. Some of the aquatic life there has been affected by both runoff and effluence from major cities to which Elkhorn is connected, including Georgetown and Lexington. So that's a major concern of mine, as it was in the course I taught, environmental issues and how we too often unknowingly become complicit in the degradation of natural places.
I wish we had more time. There's so much we could talk about. I know that that many people in this region, in our listening area, are familiar with the Elkhorn, or if they're not, and hear this, they're going to be. Of course, I guess that could be a concern as well. But I wonder if you could leave us with a reading from your book, perhaps the Feast of Silence, if you would.
Happy to. There are a couple of poems in the book, and this is one of them. The Feast of Silence. Rounding the bend of Elkhorn, I see the first angler, solitary, standing motionless, waist deep in green water, shafts of saffron light falling short of the shade in which he swishes his fly across the stillness, air about him laden with an aqua muzziness in which dust motes seem suspended. Around the next, I see more of their number, a pair in a fishing kayak drawn off the cove, another in a floppy hat hunkered at the water's edge on a sloping stone that must have fallen from the cliffs above before the first keel scraped Plymouth Rock. Lost in fisher reveries, the brief reprieve from jobs, the raucous levees of family, they do not seem too anxious for the catch so much as to feed a patient hunger. Content to hold place their lives on hold, they pause like the dragonfly lighting on the knuckle of one paddle hand to take in the drooping limbs, the scree of an invisible hawk, the white knot of roots on the sycamore whose falling leaves are riddled to gauze by insects. These things that can never be summed but only relished as a meal more substantial than fish, a stay beyond the creek against the hard symmetries of the world, beyond the incessant drone of traffic and scrapings of famished souls, as they feel themselves replenished, feeding on this Feast of Silence.
Dr. Richard Taylor reading the Feast of Silence. Dr. Taylor, we appreciate your time. He is the author of Elkhorn, Evolution of a Kentucky Landscape, published by the University Press of Kentucky, and thank you for being with us.
Tom, thank you.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of ONE, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our chief production engineer and editor. Colin Overton, editor-in-chief of the EKU campus paper Eastern Progress, is our intern. Eastern Standard's growing list of content partners includes WEKU News, the Ohio Valley Resource, the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, Kentucky Humanities, the Kentucky Historical Society, the Lexington Herald Leader, the Richmond Register, Undermain, the EKU Chautauqua Lecture Series, the Transylvania University Creative Intelligence Lecture Series. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.